It would be nice to believe, but dangerous to say, that there's a lull in the Watergate scandals. Unless you had the last-minute bulletins off the news ticker in your hand before you, that is, before I, faced the microphone. And we are now settling into what has been called the Sam Irvin Show. This is the investigation of Watergate by a select committee of the Senate, whose chairman is the engaging but formidable figure of Senator Sam Irvin of North Carolina, a 76-year-old Southerner who looks as homely as a turnip, is a one-man anthology of biblical tags and Southern folk wisdom, but who has a mind like a trap and is probably the best constitutional lawyer who has ever sat in the Senate. He is, you might say, handmade or God-sent, considered as a Daniel come to judgment on the wheeler dealers and the private power maniacs who seem to have constituted the president's White House staff. A smooth Eastern lawyer might have ferreted out the same malpractices and come to the same conclusions. A lofty and disinterested Supreme Court justice also. But they would not carry the weight with the American people that is possible to a thoroughly honest man who seems of the earth earthy, who yet retains the instinctive courtesy of an old-fashioned Southerner, and whose nuggets of wisdom about the ways of mankind are closer to the language of Mark Twain than, shall we say, Dr. Kissinger. Senator Irvin is also over 70, the age at which good men in politics are most useful because it's an age when men of character cease to give a damn. They say what's on their minds, and they leave the tact and circumlocution and the writhing federal prose to the young smart boys. Talking about any man from the president down who has put his foot in his mouth, they tend to say that he made a mistake or pulled a boner. They leave the White House press secretary to say that all of the president's previous statements about Watergate are inoperative. Well, a few weeks ago, the Washington Post and the president's counsel, John Dean, between them were spilling so many beans, anticipating so many indictments of bigwigs, the last two of whom were two former cabinet officers, Mr. John Mitchell and Mr. Maurice Stans, that it seemed to me the Senate committee had had the rug pulled out from under it. Senator Irvin is neither an ambitious nor a malevolent man, and he's not out, like the late Senator Joseph McCarthy, to prove himself the terror of the Republic, nor, like the late purple-faced Senator Toby of New Hampshire, to put on a show as God's angry man. When Senator Irvin first announced that his committee would conduct its own investigation, it was because the government itself, through two of its agencies, the White House and the Department of Justice, was, to put it politely, dragging its feet. We shouldn't forget an odd and overlooked irony in the history of this committee. It first came into the news when Senator Irvin suspected that the real story of Watergate lay in the White House, and he announced that he meant to summon, if necessary, to subpoena White House staff aides to testify. He was immediately rebuffed by Mr. Nixon, who said he would order his aides not to go and help the committee, on the constitutional grounds that they shared the president's own immunity from questioning by a congressional committee. Since the beginning of the Republic, since the emergence of investigating committees anyway, indignant congressmen have tried bringing presidents up to Capitol Hill to testify. Jefferson was the one who told them that he had separate powers and private information which they had no business to probe into. And a House committee only a little more than 20 years ago announced it would subpoena President Harry Truman. And he told them to read the Constitution and go fly a kite. But in the past, and in recent times, close presidential advisers, cabinet officers and such have been called like any other citizen. I'll never forget the two-day grilling that Senator Fulbright and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee gave the then Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, over Vietnam. The point is that a congressional committee can do this. In fact, the most important power of Congress, and it is still, thank God, operative, is its power as a watchdog over the other two arms of the government. It can call everybody except the president. It can insist that they answer questions. If they refuse, it can take a majority vote to decide if the question is reasonable and unlikely to imperil national security. And if it so decides, and the witness still refuses, then he can be cited by the committee for contempt of Congress. And if he's a persistent type, he can go to jail. Now, Senator Ervin knows all this better than anybody and could undoubtedly cite hundreds of historical precedents. So that when Mr. Nixon solemnly announced that his aides would not testify because of their hallowed right of what we now call executive privilege, Senator Ervin threw a press conference, only the second, I think, he's ever held in his life, and he said, "There's a line in Shakespeare, 'What meat doth this Caesar eat that he grows so great?' And I say to you, what meat do these White House aides eat that they grow so great? We abolished titles of nobility in the long ago, and if these men refuse to come down here, I shall instruct the sergeant of arms of the Senate to go to the White House and fetch him down here. They are as subject to questioning just like any other citizen. The president calls it executive privilege. I call it executive poppycock." Senator Ervin mused that maybe President Nixon's knowledge of constitutional law had grown rusty since he took his law degree, and he suggested that the president sign up for a refresher course at Duke University. "We, unhappily, have no record of what Mr. Nixon said when he heard this suggestion, but evidently somebody did a little homework, and on second thoughts the president recanted." The ignored irony I mentioned lay in the fact that the president's first refusal to let his men appear was based on the argument that the White House had done a thorough investigation of its own and found that nobody in the White House was in the least implicated in Watergate. And you know who was given the job of conducting that thorough investigation. None other than John Dean, the White House lawyer who suddenly, when both the FBI's arm and the arm of Senator Ervin began to turn up pay dirt, suddenly saw himself about to be used as a scapegoat, began to confess to awful things, was fired, and then told all, to investigators for the Senate committee and to the government prosecutors laying the Watergate case before a grand jury. John Dean is the man who informed, and he must be thoroughly hated by all the men who are now, at the best, deeply suspect. Well, his secret testimony before the grand jury was leaked to the press, and as I say, you might think that Senator Ervin's committee had been robbed of the business on its agenda. But apparently, Mr. Dean knows still more than we know, more than he's told the grand jury. At any rate, 2 days before Senator Ervin's committee began its investigation on Thursday, it voted unanimously to ask the courts to grant Dean what is called testimonial immunity. Now, this also is a traditional procedure between congressional committees and the courts. The idea is to allow a man to testify everything he knows before a committee on the given understanding that his testimony will not be used in a criminal case later. He may not have his testimony before a committee quoted in a trial, as grand jury testimony may be, as the basis for bringing in a perjury charge, say. In other words, if the court agrees that a man has valuable stuff to reveal, it will grant the committee's request for immunity and so release him from the hazard of double jeopardy. By the way, the courts routinely always grant this immunity. But there's some resistance to Dean's case by federal prosecutors who suspect that it would be impossible to develop incriminating evidence independently and so his immunity before the Irvin Committee might protect him forever against prosecution. We shall see. At any rate, the committee's request of the courts and Senator Irvin's diligence in pressing on with the investigation suggest that there's more dirt under the rug and that the end is not yet. Meanwhile, the most extraordinary comment on the Watergate case, extraordinary to the point of being unique, has come from Moscow. At least it's been pretty well established by American correspondents behind the Iron Curtain that the communist line, now being handed down by official journalists, and there are no others, in Belgrade, Bucharest, Warsaw, and Moscow, originated in Moscow and is the rationale behind Mr. Brezhnev's announcement of the dates on which he will visit President Nixon next month. The official communist interpretation of Watergate is certainly something that never occurred to the Washington Post. It is that Watergate is a conspiracy by reactionary American elements who want to refreeze the Cold War and arrest good relations between the communist and Western worlds. Most of us are so used to having Moscow identify bankers and Republicans as reactionary American elements that it's rather a shock to find that the new reactionary elements are liberals and Democrats who, in fact, were far ahead of Mr. Nixon in pleading for warmer relations with the Soviet Union. But no, it is practically compulsory in the communist countries to like Mr. Nixon and think of him as the best possible American president, as a Polish broadcaster described him this week. Mr. Brezhnev has recently been opposed by elements in Russia who are against the liquidating of the Cold War. So he has simply liquidated them. And he must be puzzled to know why, as Art Buchwald put it, Mr. Nixon doesn't simply liquidate the investigators, get the army to arrest Congress, and put those nosy newspaper men in insane asylums. As for bugging the other party, it is, of course, routine in the Soviet Union to bug one's own party. Well, let us pray that in the end Mr. Nixon will come out of it clean, if gullible. It would be dreadful if his popularity continued its toboggan slide, if the man that the Soviets hated more than any other American 20 years ago should come to say, "All right, if you don't like me here, I'm going to pack up and join the people who really appreciate me, my friends and admirers in the Kremlin."